Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Brash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Our show tonight brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox, shipping great tasting and wholesome snacks right to your door. Forget the vending machine. You can snack smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like toasted cheddar sticks. Support this show. Order your free NatureBox sampler box at naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. Few things before we get into the meat of the discussion tonight. We're talking about goodness, goodness in the secular model, goodness for its own sake, goodness because we are human beings, we are humanists. And are we really more good today than we were yesterday? Is there more goodness in the world? Surely doesn't seem like it, but we're going to talk about that here in just a second. I've got some very special guests. I've got John Figdor, who's the humanist chaplain at Stanford University, and there are many who think that humanist chaplain is an oxymoron. We're going to ask him about that. I've got Dale McGowan, the executive director of the Foundation Beyond Belief. He's done an amazing amount of great humanitarian work with that organization. And Michael Shermer's got a new book called The Moral Arc. And I've got Shermer coming up on the broadcast tonight. We're going to ask him, look, isn't the world going to hell in a handbasket? What's the story? How can we have sort of a rising moral arc if everything we see on the news is so shitty? So we're going to find out more about that in just a second. But first, let me do a little housekeeping real fast. The first stop in our Australia tour, the Unholy Trinity Down Under, Friday night, the 12th, going to be in Sydney at the Seymour Centre. And then next Wednesday in Brisbane at Brisbane City Hall and Melbourne at Story Hall on the 21st, plus some other dates scattered in there. And there are still tickets if you would like to go. Go to unholytrinitydownunder.com for all the tickets and details. We, my friends, have been nominated for the 10th Annual Podcast Awards. That event is coming up on April the 14th. In Las Vegas, and I was informed just last week that we are on the list. We are nominated for Best Podcast under the category Religion Inspiration. Now, you can vote, and I guess that's how the winners are selected, is people just go and they just check the box. We're up against The Scathing Atheist, The Mormon Faircast, Infants on Thrones. I've never heard of this. Mormon Discussion, The Sci-Fi Christian, Paula White's Hope for Today, and others. Anyway, if you feel so inclined, as soon as you can, log on to podcastawards.com and then scroll down to Religion Inspiration to find us and give a vote for the Thinking Atheist radio broadcast. I don't know what the deadline for voting is. I mean, it could be right upon us. So do it now if you can. Podcastawards.com, and we'll see how we fare when the awards are announced in mid-April in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm not going to Vegas. I'm just going to have to hear about it online, or maybe I can find a stream or something on the internet. I'd be curious about how we do. Wouldn't it be wild to see an atheist radio show win in the religion category? I just think there's a beauty in that, you know. Finally, real fast, the pre-orders on my new book, Sacred Cows, A Lighthearted Look at Belief and Tradition Around the World, almost done. The pre-orders are autographed and personalized. They are the first batch of books that actually goes through my hands. So if someone would like an autographed copy, this is your chance. As soon as I get back from Australia, we pull the plug on that. And then it goes out in April on the official sites. It goes out to Amazon. It'll be on Barnes & Noble. And there will be digital versions. There'll be an audiobook this summer. But the pre-orders, those can be autographed and personalized if you would like to do that. But you need to do it now, because just a few days left and then we're going to transition out of the pre-orders and get ready for the official release in April of 2015. Everything you need on that is online at sacredcowsbook.com. Sorry about all of the sort of promotion here at the beginning of the show, but we've got a lot going on, and I wanted to make sure that you had the information in case you would like to support it and you'd like to be a part of it. So thank you. I do appreciate your support. I appreciate all you've been and all you've done for the Thinking Atheist, for me and my life, for this site, for this show, for the videos, for the influence we're having out there. This would not happen without you. And so thank you from me to you from the bottom of my heart. You are greatly, greatly appreciated. We're going to spend this evening talking about goodness for goodness sake. And we'll kick that off in about 60 seconds. First, I would like to encourage you, if you get a window sometime tonight, to log on and check out naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. They have been a sponsor on the radio for a number of months now. I'm glad to have them, with over 100 nutritionist-approved snacks, something for everybody. Delicious treats like roasted kettle kernels, the dried California peaches, toffee almond granola, cashew crumble, the jalapeno white cheddar popcorn, tons of stuff to choose from, and it tastes good. Zero artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, 0 grams trans fats, 0 high fructose corn syrup, and right now your chance to get a trial box that features 5 of their most popular snacks. So log on to the website, browse around, check it out, and start your free trial right now at naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. naturebox.com/thinkingatheist. My first guest tonight is the current humanist chaplain at Stanford University. He is the very first university humanist chaplain on the West Coast. He has a master's degree in humanism and interfaith dialogue from Harvard Divinity School. And last year, he joined together with Lex Bayer to co-author the book Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century. John Figdor joins me on the radio tonight. John, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Do you call yourself an atheist? Do you call yourself a humanist? What's the story?
Yeah, I'm an atheist and I'm a humanist. I think it's really important for us to identify both of these different things because they point at different parts of our identity. When we called the book Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart, some people might have thought, they're saying that atheists are all about the head and humanists are all about the heart. That's not what we're trying to say. What we're trying to say is that everyone's got a little bit of both in them, and that if you're one of the people who broadly is involved in the non-religious movement, the secular movement, it's really that combination of both not believing in God or other supernatural phenomena and believing in human goodness and the ability of people to make a difference.
You really believe in human goodness, John?
I do. I really do. It's such a privilege for me to work at a place like Stanford where my students are so bright and so thoughtful, and most of them are engaged in really philanthropic projects, things like designing low-cost medical devices to be used in the third world to extend human life. And that just makes me so excited to come to work every day and to meet these brilliant students who are not just smart and thoughtful, but are compassionate and empathetic. And that's why it's the best job in the world.
Well, I'm setting you up a little bit. I'm of the same mindset. I mean, the people who are the agents of chaos in this world get a lot of press. You know, I always like to go back and talk about the Boston Marathon bombers. It was just two rogues who went in and ruined so many lives. But even though those two did a tremendous amount of damage, the thousands upon thousands upon thousands who went in to be helpers, to be healers, to be agents of positive change, to try to mend the wounds, to try to help those who had been hurt and afflicted and comfort the family of those who'd been killed. I mean, when you see the goodness of people in action, it does sort of give you hope for the species, doesn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, it reminds me of an anecdote from my past. I grew up outside of New York City in Westchester County, and so I was in New York when the towers came down in 9/11. And then, you know, that was probably the worst day America had experienced in, you know, quite some time at that point. And it would be very easy to be given into despair and think, look at the awful harm that people can do to other people, just the monstrous things that people do. But it was the little things that day. All the stories I heard of people who took in friends, family, complete strangers they'd never met before and said, hey, you know, if you're having trouble getting home because the bridges and tunnels are closed, stay here overnight. If you need a place to crash, you're welcome to have my couch. And it's those little signs of humanity that we see that really gives me faith that even though people can be nasty and brutish and awful, they really do have the capacity for greatness and for compassion. And that when we stimulate that, people really do behave the way that we would want them to.
I find myself fighting despair and discouragement sometimes, not to be melodramatic, it's not my point, but I mean, you know, you and I live in a culture where, thanks to the media, we see immediately the worst of the worst. You know, we live in the era of the execution video, you know, where some Middle Eastern nation decides somebody is guilty of the crime of blasphemy, and not only do they kill them horribly, but they decide to broadcast it to the rest of the world. And I'll tell you, you see that stuff, and it's easy just to die a little bit in your heart, which is probably what they want. I mean, do you ever struggle with that? You just think, yeah, this information overload, so much of it is negative, it just brings me down.
I really do. I find it quite depressing sometimes. But then I think to myself, and I look at the rate of atheism growth in the world, and that really makes me feel better. Because so many of the sources of this brutality, they come from conservative religious traditions. And as people become more secular, and as religious traditions themselves secularize, I think we're moving in the right direction. And I know we were talking about internationally, but just looking in the U.S., I mean, the numbers have changed so much since I just started out in this field. We used to brag that, you know, 20% of America was non-religious. Now, after the Barna.org polling data in October, we know that number is closer to 38 or 40%. That's an enormous, that's a doubling of percent in literally 3 years. So I think that's a trend we're seeing not just in the U.S., but in other places. And as Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, points out, the more people become civilized, the more people give up superstitious ideas and bad thinking, the more peaceful these societies become, and the fewer people that are executed.
Talking here with Jonathan Figdor, the humanist chaplain at Stanford. Do you ever take any shit for humanist chaplain? I mean, those two words side by side, people ever talk to you and say, what are you doing?
Yeah, you know, I actually get it from both sides. I get it from religious people who are just, how could you possibly be a chaplain to these people? And then I get it from atheists who are like, why would you waste your time being a chaplain to people who don't believe in this? But I think people basically misunderstand what we do. What we do is broadly three things. We exist to build, educate, and nurture a diverse community of atheists, humanists, agnostics, basically the whole non-religious spectrum at Stanford. And we do that through hosting major public events with people like Richard Dawkins. We do it through counseling students and providing resources for them, as well as advocating for them from within the Office of Religious Life. And then we do it by hosting service projects and trying to show people that you can be good without a belief in God.
You know, when I was a religious person, we used to do a lot of quote-unquote charity work. I remember most specifically, I was a spokesperson for a child sponsorship organization, Compassion International. We would fly to different third world countries and talk about how we help to feed them and clothe them and give them an education. But ultimately, really hanging over everything was this umbrella of salvation. You know, we're feeding them physically so that we can sort of grab them spiritually. There was always sort of an ulterior motive. And that's probably the big challenge I have with quote unquote religious charity, is that quite often, yeah, they do want to help people, but ultimately they have Jesus in their back pocket and they're waiting for the opportunity to sort of play that card. You know, I mean,
right.
And it's for that reason that I send them blanch a little bit whenever I see the Catholic Church doing some kind of a charity thing, because I think, well, geez, are they genuinely feeding mouths and helping people, or are they, is this a PR thing? They're trying to make converts. What's your take on that?
Look, just to make your point directly, Mother Teresa had a really interesting quote about that very subject, where she said, look, do we want our nuns and priests to be mere social workers, or do we want them to be agents for Christ? She literally called social workers mere social workers, as if to say that's like less valuable than the people who are doing it to push their religion onto other people. Talk about missing the point. You've completely missed the point. The reason that you help people is because you want to do good for goodness sakes. You want to help them out of the empathy of your heart. If you're doing it in order to get yourself some benefit in the afterlife, I mean, it doesn't sound much like morality to me. It sounds like self-interest or something like that.
Yeah, you're essentially you're sort of putting some spiritual equity away so that you can have a larger mansion in the future. And I became more of a charitable person when I rejected the idea of God, which, you know, at the time when I was a Christian would have seemed oxymoronic. How could you be charitable without Jesus? And now I literally do it just because I love doing it. It's just so gratifying, you know?
It's also this. It's that with no God to pray for, you and I realize that if you and I don't do something, or our friends or our local society, nothing's going to get done. And so if you don't have someone to pray to, you realize that it's incumbent on you to take action.
Yeah.
Like, you have to help people because there's no God that's going to do it for them.
Talking here with Jonathan Figdor, the humanist chaplain at Stanford, author of a new book, Atheist Mind, Humanist Heart. Talk to me. What are you saying in the book? Give me the Cliff's Notes version, and then I'll direct everybody to go and pick up the actual text of the book in its entirety. What are you saying?
Well, our subtitle kind of points it out. Our subtitle is Rewriting the Ten Commandments for the 21st Century, and that was the project of the book. And that's not to say that we think that we should create an atheist Ten Commandments. We call them non-commandments in the book because it's important to point out that they're not binding and you don't have to carve them into stone. They're not going to stay the same forever. But we thought the idea of taking the Ten Commandments as a jumping-off point to talk about what people really value. You know, Christians, whenever you ask them where their moral values come from, they'll say the Bible and the Ten Commandments. So we thought, well, what would an atheist version of this look like? What would an atheist list of our most important values and beliefs look like? And so that's what drove us to write the book. The first half of the book is largely about how we can learn about the nature of reality. This is more about kind of metaphysics and understanding the world around us. The second half of the book then is about human relationships, human behavior, and morality. And that's the part that I am particularly interested in.
I wish you all the best with the book and for all your work over there at Stanford. And thanks for sharing a few minutes on the radio with us. Your perspective is greatly appreciated, man.
Thank you so much for having me. You have a wonderful show. And hope you have a great day.
By the way, in case you were curious, John and Lex Bayer created the Rethink Prize, where they put together a contest last year and asked people to submit their own beliefs and reasoning to create a new Ten Commandments. Each commandment winner won a $1,000 prize. In case you're curious, the top 10 actually got a lot of press. In fact, I saw an article recently on it in Time Magazine, where they listed the top 10 winners. I won't be able to give you everybody's name who sent these in, but these are the 10 quote-unquote commandments that were part of the Rethink Prize. Number one, be open-minded and be willing to alter your beliefs with new evidence. Two, strive to understand what is most likely to be true, not to believe what you wish to be true. Three, the scientific method is the most reliable way of understanding the natural world. Four, every person has the right to control of their body. Five, God is not necessary to be a good person or to live a full and meaningful life. Six, be mindful of the consequences of all your actions and recognize that you must take responsibility for them. 7. Treat others as you would want them to treat you and can reasonably expect them to want to be treated. Think about their perspective. Number 8. We have the responsibility to consider others, including future generations. Number 9. There is no one right way to live. And number 10. Leave the world a better place than you found it. And you can just Google Rethink Prize 10 Commandments if you want to see a printed list of the winners there. Good stuff. My next guest is author of Parenting Beyond Belief and Raising Free Thinkers, as well as Voices of Unbelief, Atheism for Dummies, and the forthcoming book called Faith and in Doubt, How Religious Believers and Nonbelievers Can Create Strong Marriages and Loving Families. He is the executive director of Foundation Beyond Belief, a humanist charitable foundation that's based in Atlanta, Georgia. He's also the national director of ethical education for the American Ethical Union. And back in 2008, he was named Harvard Humanist of the Year. Dale McGowan, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Sure. Good to be here, Seth.
You've done a lot of work as a quote-unquote humanist out there. And so I thought your perspective would be valid as we talk about sort of humanist work and whatnot. If you could define humanism in that way, how would you do it? How would you frame it?
Well, for me, humanism, a lot of times it's equated with atheism, but I think there's a richer way to look at it. For me, humanism is what follows from my atheism. Once I decide that there's no God to take care of us, there's no God running the show, then the question is, okay, what do we do then? How do we treat each other? How do we make the world a better place? How do we make life as good as it can be for the most people? That's humanism. It's just that attempt to move forward in the best possible way, the most humane possible way.
Do you sort of do the atheism says what I don't believe, but humanism is about what I do believe? Do you sort of frame it like that?
Yeah, I think that's a fine way to look at it. For me, it's just one of the ways I've put it is that atheism is the first step and humanism is 1,000 steps that follow, you know, so it's just sort of a recognition that the frame has changed.
That's a t-shirt, right?
Oh,
that's
very good.
That's if it's not on a t-shirt somewhere, I think it should be, you know, humanism is 1,000 steps that follow.
Yeah.
What's some of the stuff you've been involved in recently, just for those who are just now becoming introduced to you and your work?
Well, my initial foray into the movement was through non-religious parenting work. But more recently, I've been involved in Foundation Beyond Belief, which is a humanist charitable organization, encourages giving and volunteering in the non-theistic community. And then also, I've been involved a lot in interbelief work, I guess you could put it. My most recent book was In Faith and in Doubt, which is about marriages between believers and non-believers. About 59% of married atheists are married to someone who is not an atheist, who is a believer. And so I've been working a lot in that. And that's something that causes me to constantly return to the question of what humanism is and what it isn't and how it can actually join together with other ways of looking at the world and find the way forward.
A lot of cynicism, and I understand much of it. You know, we are skeptics. We are self-described skeptics. And there's a lot of stuff out there that makes us feel good that doesn't really produce results. And so even those who aren't just nihilists about everything are often very wary of approaching something like the Foundation Beyond Belief or a humanist cause of any kind, making the world a better place, kumbaya, right?
Right.
I mean, they look at it and they go, oh, come on. It's all a bunch of crap. Nothing ever changes. Most of the money goes into the pocket of the administration. You know, you're all sheep. You're essentially trading one religion in for another. It's like they've sort of given up. And have you encountered much of that and how do you approach it?
Yeah, we've encountered some. Mostly, there hasn't been that. Mostly, people are pretty happy to see it coming up. I think a lot of people recognize that the needs we have and the question of what it is that we need to do in the world has always been here. And religion, in its best manifestations, tried to come up underneath that question and solve it, try to figure out what to do. And sometimes they got something right. You know, once in a while, they actually did figure out how to do it well. And what we're saying now is not, hey, let's get rid of everything that religion has ever thought or been or said. What we really need to do is say, hey, let's get rid of all the toxins, all the poison, all the stuff that's untrue, and see what's left that's really worth doing. You know, caring for each other is something that some religious expressions have done well. We don't want to get rid of caring for each other. You know, that's something that we should still do. And there are better and worse ways of doing it. So Foundation Beyond Belief takes an evidence-based approach to evaluating charities, vetting charities on a 35-point system, and determining which ones are most efficient and effective at making a difference, making an actual difference in the field, in the world, in the lives of other human beings.
I met Rebecca Witzman after she lost her home in the Moore, Oklahoma twister. It's an amazing story. Yeah. And we did a video interview with her where she spends, you know, we actually spoke for about an hour. The video itself runs about 15 minutes where she talks about that day, you know, when the twister hit and she grabbed her baby and essentially fled for her life and came back and there's nothing left. And she sort of translated that horrible experience into an opportunity. Is she still involved with you guys?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, she is. Thank goodness. She's a remarkable person with an incredible perspective because of that experience. And Rebecca is working in our Humanist Disaster Recovery Program, which is a rapidly developing program. We've moved beyond the fundraising drives that we've done for crisis response into organizing volunteers on the ground to respond to crises in the United States when they happen. And Rebecca is helping to lead that program. And by bringing the victim's experience into it, somebody who's actually been the victim of one of these disasters, she just brings in the most stunning perspective, things that I would never have thought about in terms of making the response victim-centered, making sure that the victims are getting what they need beyond just food and shelter, but also the emotional experience of having been stripped of everything meaningful to you. So we are just very, very grateful to have Rebecca with us.
You're such a good-natured guy. We all have our moments. I'm sure you have yours. When you see a disaster like that, and immediately you see in Krylon on the side of every house or almost every house, God bless more. Thank you, God, for rescuing us, or thank you, God, for not killing us, as opposed to the family next door, which is essentially what the message is. I mean, does anything ever kind of rise up in you, like the insanity of it all? Does it ever just frustrate you?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth on that, and I think I've... It used to only frustrate me. It used to just be the sort of thing where I wanted to shake people out of it.
Yeah.
But over time, I've started to really recognize that I'm in an unusual position. I'm in a pretty privileged position as a human being. You know, I am sheltered from most risk and insecurity. I've got a cushion of space and money around me relative to most of the people in the world. And as a result, I can sort of see my way clear to a rational view of the world that doesn't require me to bend my knees. But when someone either lives perpetually in this situation of being right on the edge of being wiped out, which a lot of people do, or has the sudden experience of being struck by a disaster, I actually empathize for the impulse to have some ultimate power that you can turn this thing around. I don't think it's there. I really don't think it's there. And I don't think it's an ideal way to respond to it. But I get it, at least. I've begun to actually look at that with a little more sympathy and empathy than I used to and feel like, you know, what I want to do is provide a viable alternative to that. That's what we're building now, a compassionate, viable alternative that can make people feel protected, that can make them feel cared for, so they don't have to turn to magic, to an idea of some sort of supernatural fix.
Interesting you brought that up. It was an article last August in The Humanist titled, "Why Are the Poor More Religious?"
Yeah.
And I guess in that context, it makes sense, right? Where you have little or no hope, you construct a mechanism for coping, for hoping, for finding a way through. And if we don't get it in this life, well, we'll get it in the next.
Yeah, and I think that also is the explanation for, you know, people shake their heads, why are women, why are African Americans so religious? You know, when they are the most reviled in the Bible, you know, when slavery is actually mandated and instructions are given for it and women are kept in their place. But it's exactly that. When you've gone through so much of your history with no hope for getting in a position of power or influence or even security, you turn to that ultimate solution. And what's happening now at last, so I think as we're starting to see more gender equality, more racial equality, as we're moving in that direction, more people in those communities are able to say, okay, I'm in a position where I can actually see that dissonance and step into a secular perspective. And I just want to make it easier for people to do that emotionally as well as intellectually.
Talking here with Dale McGowan quickly, do you think if I am that type of atheist who is kind of inward focused only, right? I'm going to take care of number one. I'm going to look out for me, even in a good way, right? So we all are self-protective in some way.
Yep.
You know, we have to be. Do you think I have a societal obligation, a moral obligation to be a humanist? Do you think we as atheists must take the next step?
Well, that's a really good question.
I'm not trying to be Barbara Walters on you here, Dale. It's something that I think about from time to time. I mean, does it have to do with how we're wired? Does it speak to the desire of our heart, what our gifts are? Or should we all feel like I should be a humanist? I should be more outward focused in my life? And I don't know that I know the answer to the question. I was just curious to another perspective.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's really a really worthwhile one. What I tend to do is speak for myself. It's difficult to say that somebody else must do something, but I feel like I have to because I've recognized that the things that I have are not all my own doing. They're not all things that I earned. They're not all things that I specifically deserved by my actions. There are a lot of advantages that I was born into. There are a lot of things that happened because of how I was raised by my parents, because of the country that I was born into and the socioeconomic class and the race that I was born into. Those things are unearned privileges that I have. And it feels entirely selfish to me and unfair for me to not try to level that playing field for people who did not get some of the same advantages that I had through no fault of their own. And that's where I am at this point in my life. And the best that I can do is encourage other people to examine that same set of dynamics in their own life and come to their own conclusions about that.
You know, I was talking to Nate Phelps, the son of the late Fred Phelps of Westboro Baptist Church, and I forgot exactly how he phrased it. I'm sure I'll screw it up here, but the gist was, you know, I didn't ask to be Fred Phelps' son. I just sort of found myself in this position. You know, I found myself in a place where, through no action really of my own, I became associated with a world-famous thing, you know? Yeah. And he made a conscious choice to turn that situation to his advantage and say, well, look, I didn't ask to be Nathan Phelps, but now that I am, I'm going to use this platform to try to effect some positive change in the world. And he's become a human rights activist in Canada, here in the United States. And it's just done an amazing thing. I guess that speaks to all of us examining where we are, the tools we have, and then using those tools in the most effective way possible.
Oh, absolutely. And the one thing that I know from, because I've talked to Nathan as well, really an amazing person and another great perspective. And one of the things that I know he has is ongoing empathy for those who haven't found their way out. And that's something that I think is really a valuable perspective.
Yeah, it was true when his father died. A lot of folks were ready to go piss on Fred's grave. I mean, they were ready to go and essentially flip the coin completely and say, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to protest at your funeral kind of thing. And even though Nate brings a lot of, I mean, he's, you know, he's got a lot of reason to be upset. Yeah. You know, his solution, he didn't say you shouldn't, you couldn't, you know, but he did say for me, you know, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to go there. He really is pretty impressive.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and there's another thing that religion sometimes gets right is the idea of forgiveness. You know, the idea that you actually let yourself out of the hole, let yourself out of jail if you just let go of something and say, I'm going to move past it. I'm not going to be in this constant state of turning around and pissing on somebody else. You know, there's a humanistic message in that as well.
Are you seeing kind of an evolution happen here? I mean, the atheist movement, I haven't been involved in just a few years, right? I started in 2009, a freshly emerged and slightly rattled apostate, you know, looking around going, what is this strange new world I'm in? But even since those days, the temperature seems to be changing a little bit. We seem to be, and maybe I've got it wrong, we seem to be a little less angry, you know, a little less angry, a little less eager to shake our fist at somebody else, a little less inclined to start with the insult. And I don't know if it's just the circle I'm in, that temperature there, and that little sort of microcosm's changing, or if you're seeing it as well out there.
Oh, no doubt. It's really been about the last 5 years. It's been an incredible sea change. But what I really think it is, I think it's those voices have always been there. That perspective's always been present. And I think it's finding its voice and it's finding its feet within the movement. And it's a very natural thing in a movement. I think initially you will have the stronger voices trying to break through this frustrating cultural hegemony of religion. And so you get the really aggressive voices. And then once you've started to establish a certain critical mass, you can flesh out that voice and you can find more of a spectrum of voices. And I think that's exactly what's happening. We're actually in a place where we've stormed the castle. You know, actually in the castle, inside the culture more than we once were, and we're able to actually assert more of that spectrum, which I think is entirely a positive thing.
We're not just destroying the false, we are promoting the true, or at least what is substantiated by the evidence.
Yeah.
Any final words on this sort of the thought of humanism, of how we can be more effective in helping other people? I mean, the church has an amazing model for community assistance and aid. They've got programs for anybody and everybody who's going through something in their life. They're certainly well marketed and well organized. You know, they've got divorce recovery and they've got grief recovery and they've got a singles ministry and youth. And don't get me started on young children. They've got something for everyone. How can we be the most effective, in your opinion, out there?
Well, I really think that the key to breaking through this is to recognize that we are all people. You know, that it's been human beings all through the centuries trying to figure this stuff out. And for a long time, there was the frame around it was faulty. The basic frame was this theistic frame that understood that things were coming from of supernatural intelligence, whatever. Within that frame, we tried to solve the problems of existence. A lot of times the frame really screwed up the answers that we had. But there are also a lot of things that happened in that frame that are worth building on. And so we should never, never look at something that the church has done and immediately reject it out of hand because the church did it. Instead, we have to look at it and say, okay, once the frame's removed, what is left there that's worth pursuing and it's worth building on? I think that's exactly what we're doing now. That's what humanist groups around the country are doing in building communities and starting disaster relief and working with the poor and so on. They're recognizing that this is something humans have always done with an inaccurate frame. Now we're going to do many of the same things and simply have it in the structure that we now know is an accurate way of looking at the world.
Now, under that umbrella, do you advocate partnerships between free thought secular groups and church groups in some endeavor? I mean, hey, we're teaming up with the First Church of whatever, and we're going to all go down and feed hungry people at the homeless shelter. I mean, is there merit in that?
Oh, gosh, absolutely, yes. One of the reasons for that is that progressive believers have a great deal more in common with the non-religious than they do with the fundamentalists. And if we can demonstrate that by hooking up with these progressives, by working together on the things that we do have common ground in, that will do more than anything to isolate the toxins, right? The poison will be over there in the corner. And here are the progressive religious and the progressive non-religious joining together in the values that matter. I think that's the most powerful thing we can do right now to fight the real poison of religion.
Dale McGowan, thank you so much for your time and perspective. Once again, been fantastic.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Seth.
Quite often when you and I are talking to people about the state of the world, we read the headlines, we see how crazy things are, how crazy they seem, and people often sort of wax nostalgic about the good old days. Oh, I miss the good old days. Or wouldn't it have been nice to live in simpler times when things were less crazy, less violent, more moral, more happy? We kind of paint this Norman Rockwell painting in our mind of how things used to be. But Dr. Michael Shermer says we're actually wrong about fondly looking backward, and he has a new book called The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. I wanted to speak to Michael about that. He is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's a monthly columnist for Scientific American. He's a regular contributor to Time.com. He's a presidential fellow at Chapman University, and he's authored many books, including The Believing Brain, From Ghosts to Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths, Why Darwin Matters, Evolution and the Case Against Intelligent Design, and The Science of Good and Evil. He's appeared on shows such as The Colbert Report, 2020, Dateline, Charlie Rose, Larry King Live, and others. Dr. Michael Shermer, thanks for joining us on the show tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be back.
So things today are so much worse than they used to be. I mean, you look at the news and all it is famine and war and terrorism and brutality and darkness and sadness and pain and anguish. And I've actually heard this argument made by people who are religious, who believe it's the end times, right? It's so bad out there. It's so much worse than it's ever been. What would your response be to that statement?
Well, as the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, I would say I'm skeptical.
Yeah.
You know, the point of the moral arc is to say, in fact, our intuitions about that, which are most people's intuitions, and they'd be mine too if I only ever watched the news, are wrong. That the long-term trends are all in the right direction in almost any category you want to measure. life is better for more people in more places more of the time. And by better, I mean the survival and flourishing of sentient beings, which is my moral starting point. Sentient meaning emotive, responsive, capable of feeling and suffering and loving and you know, all the experiences of a full life, and not just human sentient beings, but other animals as well. And individuals, it's the individual sentient beings that count, because the individuals that can feel and emote and suffer and love and so forth, it's those individual brains that are perceiving that. And that's what evolution vouchsafed us, to have that instinctive desire to survive and flourish. So that's my moral starting point, that I'm saying that natural rights, I'm making a natural rights argument. So in fact, that's, you know, by most measures, it is really good. And we can see these rights revolutions, we can see one unfolding right before our eyes right now, gay rights and same-sex marriage. Now, my book just came out less than a month ago, and it's already out of date on the number of states that allow same-sex marriage. I mean, it changes by the week. And so it's a beautiful slice of history unfolding before us, because we've had so many rights revolutions already. And you can see who opposes it. All the major mainstream religions oppose same-sex marriage, or they have. You know, with the exception of the Episcopalians, Unitarians, you know, these are very secular Jews, very liberal, you know, liberalizing type religions. But Baptists, Protestants, Evangelicals, all against it. And they will all change their mind, I predict. And they will all then say, you know what, we were always in favor of same-sex marriage. God loves everybody, including gays.
It really feels a little counterintuitive when you're watching the news in the era of ISIS, right? We're watching people, stories of people getting their heads sawed off by these barbarians and all that kind of stuff. And then you say the world is getting better. It just seems to clash in the mind.
Mm-hmm. Just remember, centuries ago, Christians used to behead Jews and burn women alive as witches. It was not uncommon 500 years ago. And we stopped all that. What happened is that those religions went through the Enlightenment, and they came out the other side more enlightened, more civilized, less violent, more rational in their beliefs. And certain sects of Islam have not gone through an Enlightenment. They would like nothing better than to return to a 13th century, 12th century theocracy in which, you know, women have no rights and, you know, all that. And so, you know, that's progress even in religion. Religions do progress. They make changes. They adopt the values of the society in which they're embedded. And if they're embedded in a Western liberal type society, one of the liberal democracies, then they're likely to be less violent.
So when Bill Donahue with the Catholic League goes ballistic about President Obama's National Prayer Breakfast statement that horrible things were done in the name of Christianity, he really has no foundation to be upset. It's simply a statement of fact.
Yeah, that's right. President Obama was just stating historical facts of things that happened. I mean, it's true. Everybody knows it. I mean, you can't have gone through school of any number of years and not know about the Inquisitions and the Crusades and the witch burnings and all that. Everybody knows that. It's in pop culture. It's in movies. It's just a fact of what happened. The question is, why did it happen? And why isn't it happening anymore? So the moral arc is attempting to document that.
So what is the arc is an actual, you've drawn some kind of a physical arc showing the upward or downward arc of morality.
Well,
can you kind of spell it out,
you know,
for
it's
me?
It's a metaphor. It's Dr. Martin Luther King's famous speech at the climax of his march from Selma to Montgomery, in which he, you know, used a number of religious tropes, one of which was, how long do we have to wait? You know, not long, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. He got that from a 19th century preacher named Theodore Parker, who said of the moral universe that the arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and determine its path, but from what I see, I'm sure it bends toward justice. And so that was 1853, a decade before, you know, the end of the Civil War and the abolition of slavery. So that was a piece of real optimism there, when pessimism might have been the day, maybe some wishful thinking. But that's, in a way, what I'm arguing is that we can actually track it through data and charts and graphs, which I provide, of all the different expansion of rights, you know, the abolition of slavery, the abolition of torture, the granting of the franchise to, you know, all adults in a society, in a democracy, which is now universal everywhere in the world except for Saudi Arabia, which may give women the right to vote this year, and Vatican City, which will never give women the right to do anything. But otherwise, you know, that's an example of one of those moral arc tracks. And so it's mostly metaphorical as an arc. But another way to think about it is an expanding moral sphere. That is, the sphere of who we count as an honorary member of our in-group, our family, our community, our society that we want to be nice to, social with, cooperative, pro-social. That has been expanding. More and more people count as a member of our in-group. And that's also as a result of these, you know, multiple forces at work. The largest one in general, these sort of secular-based, science and reason-based ideas, ideas that were discovered or invented in the 17th and 18th centuries that we call the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment. And those movements were themselves spawned by the scientific revolution. You know, the idea Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Newton gave us is that the world is governed, the universe, the world is governed by natural laws. And we can discover those laws and even write equations to describe how those laws work and then apply them to the world itself to change it and make it a better place. So all thinkers since that time have actively, consciously, and they said so, trying to be the Newton of their field, of physics, of, I mean, of, you know, politics, of economics, of culture, society, whatever. The moral sciences, as David Hume called them. You know, we should take this idea that an economy is governed by principles that we can understand, like supply and demand, and then apply it and see if we can make it a better economy or a better political system. And so I have a whole chapter on that in which I talk about, for example, Thomas Hobbes. You know, in his great book, The Leviathan, he starts with, basically he says, I am the Galileo of civil society. It's a rather immodest statement. But the idea was that he starts this book, you know, but most political scientists consider Leviathan to be the greatest political tract ever written, most influential, I mean. And he starts off with atoms, particles in motion in the universe. What does that got to do with politics? Well, he's building, by way of association of psychology and materialist philosophy, that everything in the world, from atoms to people, are governed by natural laws and we can understand them. Now, he ends up with defending the monarchy and the English Civil War, but that's neither here nor there. The idea is that he designs a political system based on rational principles. Now, he may be wrong, but the idea that we can discover rational principles and defend them and argue about them and debate them and figure out which principles are better than others or which are more likely to be true than others, that's what reason and science is all about. So when I say how science and reason bend the arc of the moral universe, I'm talking about that general idea, you know, not the technology of iPhones or atomic bombs, but the principle that things are knowable and we can know them.
Talking here with Michael Shermer. Michael, do you believe in evil? Or maybe a better way to phrase it would be, if you believe in evil, how would you define it? You know, that kind of thing. Do you want to address the issue of evil?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, people use that word in a very loose way, often meaning in sort of almost a theological or metaphysical sense that something has inhabited the brains of people, causing them to commit evil deeds or deeds that we don't like, deeds that are really, really bad on the scale, and so the worst is evil. That I reject. I don't think that's the case, with the exception of people with brain tumors or psychopaths or, you know, serial killers that have some screwball wiring of their brains. That may be evil in that sort of weird sense, but even that has a physiological reason for it. What I'm talking about is just most people. Most of us have a propensity to commit acts of violence, not gratuitously, not for fun, but because you have to stand up and fight for yourself, because there are people, bullies, you know, other people that just exploit others, and the propensity in human nature to want to take advantage of others is there in all of us. So, as Richard Dawkins says in the Selfish Gene, you know, the difference between kicking a rock and kicking another organism is that the other organism might kick back, and therefore you have to calculate in your behaviors. Well, I can exploit the rock, but I can't exploit this other survival machine, this other organism, because he's probably thinking of exploiting me, and he knows that I know that he is thinking that I'm thinking that I'm going to exploit him, and so on and so on. And so it ends up as a strategy. It pays to cooperate and be pro-social, reciprocally altruistic, and so on. But occasionally, when somebody doesn't play nice by the rules, you have to stand up and fight back. You have to take revenge. You have to seek justice, sometimes violently. And so in that sense, it's part of our nature to have those propensities. You have to have those in a social species designed by natural selection. So it isn't that it's evil, it's that it's part of our nature. And the whole point of a civil society is to structure it in a way to incentivize people to be nice, to be cooperative, to play by the rules, and that'll benefit everybody. All of us will be better off. And to disincentivize exploitative attacks, instrumental violence, you know, those sorts of things. And that's what we've already been doing for centuries. If somebody is trying to exploit you, even just slightly, just a little bit, it pays you to stand up and say, no, that's not acceptable. I will not let you exploit me. Well, that's a kind of, I wouldn't say violence, but it's a way of, you know, defending yourself. You have to do that. There's a series of experiments called common goods games that behavioral economists play. So here's one that I discuss in The Moral Arc. So four subjects are sitting around a table. I give each of them 10 $1 bills. And they then voluntarily put in anonymously as much of money as they like into the common pot, which I then multiply by 1.5 and redistribute amongst the four of them equally. So what everybody should do is put $10 in completely. That's 40 bucks times 1.5 is 60 bucks divided by four. Everybody gets $15. Everybody just made 5 bucks. Sweet. Nice deal. Now, these are poor, starving college students, so they need the money. They're motivated. And you would think in the second round, third round, fourth round, we just keep playing. They keep doing this. They keep putting all $10 in, the whole amount. What in fact happens is that one or two or a few of them start to cheat a little better, just hold back a few bucks and not put in quite as much as they did previously. And so they get ahead a little bit. They free ride. They cheat the system just a tiny bit. But what happens is that the other players soon discover, wait a minute, somebody's holding out here because I put my full amount in and I'm not getting as much back. That means somebody held back and that's not cool. So I'm not putting in as much the next time. And the whole thing collapses within a few rounds. People just quit being cooperative. Then in a second set of conditions, this experimenters, this is Fair and Gachter, 2002 study published in Science, they had a condition in which the donations to the common goods were transparent. Everybody knew how much everybody else put in. And then there was an opportunity to punish those who were, you know, not playing nice, not being very cooperative. And all of a sudden, everybody became very cooperative, generous, and nice. They were playing by the rules. Okay, so the point of those is that we need our human nature is such that we need rules to enforce, incentivize us to be good. And, you know, we do have a good nature, it's true, but it takes some encouragement to do that, a social structure that incentivizes that, that de-incentivizes the negative aspects of our human nature.
I'm watching a discussion on YouTube at this, almost at this very moment. It's a religious person who's come forward and said, how do you know something is right or wrong? Good or bad? How do you know it's productive or destructive unless you have the objective moral standard? And I know you probably addressed the objective moral standard and the standard giver argument in the past. I don't know if you address it in the moral arc, but does evolution help explain moral, ethical deeds? Do you address that at all?
I do, yes, absolutely. Of course, first of all, the claim that without God, you can't have objective morality is false. But even if it were true, that is to say, there is a God who, you know, wrote down the rules and handed them to us. How do we know that that's what he said? I mean, how do you know that? How do you even know that's true? You know, because we know these books are written by people. So how do you know the people were inspired by God? In any case, as Plato pointed out long ago, did God write down those particular principles because they really are better? You know, the golden rule, say, whatever, thou shalt not murder, whatever the rules are. I mean, would those rules stand anyway? Is God saying, look, here's the moral rule. It really is good. And I'm just telling you, this is what it is. Well, you don't need God to say it if it's really true. And if it's only because God says it, then it's just entirely arbitrary. Because if you have a different God that you believe in, he may have a different set of rules. So, so even that argument doesn't hold up. But then going the other direction, it's not true that without that, there, you know, anything goes, all morality is relative, all right and wrong is determined entirely culturally. You know, that's not true either. We have an evolved sense of right and wrong, guilt and jealousy, anger, vengeance, just the desire for justice and so on. All those things are there. As a social primate species, we have to have those moral emotions to guide our behavior in a way that leads to the greater survival and flourishing of ourselves and our immediate kin and kind. And so I'm saying that they're objective and true and real because we were born with them. It's part of our nature. So I'm ultimately making a natural rights argument that we're born with certain characteristics that drive us to desire, you know, certain things, exceptions aside, you know, psychopaths, sadists, or whatever, but you know, the vast majority of people have these certain desires. You know what's right and wrong. You have a sense, a little still small voice within your conscious or whatever you want to call it. It's there, and we all know what it is.
Well, how do you address the altruistic act, you know, the selfless act toward others? If what I do benefits the tribe, what benefits the tribe benefits us as a species. I mean, there's some merit to how that's for, I mean, can you phrase that better? But I mean, is that essentially how we frame it?
Yeah, that's right. It's a problem of altruism in evolutionary theory. Why would a selfish gene-based organism want to help anybody ever? You should always exploit everybody all the time and grab as many resources as you can so that your own genes are passed along. Well, that was worked out long ago. You know, Dawkins' famous book, The Selfish Gene, was really a sort of synthesis of the work that was going on at that time, just a few years before that, by William Hamilton and Robert Trivers and a few others on kin selection, on reciprocal altruism, on, you know, all the ways in which social organisms do make sacrifices for other group members and other relations, because it does, in fact, help you get your genes into the next generation by you being nice to somebody else. There's a couple ways that does it. If you're genetically related to somebody, it's your brother or your child or whatever, then making a sacrifice for them, you know, it does have a direct calculable payoff. But even people that are not genetically related to you, if you're nice to them, you're cooperative and so on, then they're more likely to be nice and cooperative to you when the chips are down for you, when you need help. And that's the whole point of being a social species, is we're, you know, we're in this together. We got to help each other because life is hard. You know, the second law of thermodynamics says shit happens. You know, bad things happen. You know, we're not always going to have food and shelter, and there's dangerous predators out there. We got to stick together. So here, a lot of people move in the direction of group selection. I don't. I think it's entirely just pure natural selection operating on the individual organism. Because it's not enough for me to pretend to be a nice, moral, cooperative, altruistic person, because people would detect if you're faking. In time, people that you spend a lot of time with. You can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool your fellow group members forever, because you will leak the fact that you're faking. So in that sense, you have to really feel good about doing moral acts in a very deep sense, that you feel like it was a moral thing to do and you feel good about it. Or in the opposite sense, you feel guilt about violating some social contract or a deal with somebody or a relationship. And that guilt feeling is real. It's deep inside. It's not faked. And so that's, in that sense, morals are real. They exist. They exist as part of our nature.
Talking here with Michael Shermer, if there is indeed a moral arc, so you just say it's pretty much guaranteed in a matter of years, you know, weeks, months, years, decades, whatever, we will be a more civilized, more ethical, more moral species as a whole. And it's inevitable?
No, not inevitable. My argument is not that there's no arrow to history that had to unfold from the Big Bang till yesterday. That, in fact, it could be reversed. There are lots of, small reversals. ISIL was a classic example of a surprise reversal that took, you know, that shocked everybody. But I think that once the sphere has expanded, the arc is bent quite a ways, it's hard to reverse it. So, for example, can you imagine any country taking back the right for blacks or women to vote? You know, it's very, very unlikely. Or any state in the world reinstituting slavery as a legal institution. In their constitution, they would say, we decided, you know, the abolition of slavery was a bad idea, we're going to reinstitute it, and here is who gets to enslave who. That's very unlikely to happen. Or even someone like Putin. Now, Putin's a little bit of a, you know, setback. It's a bumpy arc. But even Putin is, you know, 19th century, he is in his thinking of, you know, the purpose of a political leader is to gobble up as much territory as possible. You know, that was very 19th century. You can't do that anymore. But what are the chances of him cobbling together a union of Soviet socialist republics that resembles anything like what Stalin did back in the 50s. You know, it's just, you know, it's so unlikely. I mean, he grabbed a little tiny piece of land, Ukraine and the Crimea there, and you know, his scorn is heaped upon him. His economy is in the toilet because of economic sanctions. You know, we're just not going to put up with that anymore. Now, it's not likely we're going to invade and go to war, but we may not need to. There's, you know, more or less violent ways of bringing about social change. So that would be an example of not inevitable, but, you know, it's not likely that those progressive trends would be overturned. So just take the gay marriage, same-sex marriage debate. You know, once the Supreme Court lays it down, probably in June, and says it's unconstitutional for states to ban same-sex marriage, that'll pretty much be the end of it. Now, you know, they could overturn it, but, you know, again, the legal precedence means it's very, very hard to override, you know, something that the Supreme Court has voted on.
Is there morality in science? Is that even the right way to phrase the question?
Well, the way I'm using it when I say, you know, the moral arc, the subtitle is, you know, how science and reason lead humanity toward truth, justice, and freedom. By science and reason, I mean the general idea, as I mentioned before, of thinking rationally and empirically about solving problems in the world. So I'm not talking about the products of science, the iPhones and the atomic bombs or whatever. I'm talking about the process of determining how we know anything is true. Like, what's the best way we should govern one another in a state? How should we design a government? How should we design a state? Well, there isn't one right answer to that, but there are a cluster of answers that are better than others. You know, democracies. You know, there's not one right democracy. You know, we're a constitutional republic. You know, the UK and England and France and Germany have, you know, three different kinds of democracies still. But the idea of all adult citizens have a right to participate in the political process on some level through some method, that is a much better system than an autocracy, a theocracy, a dictatorship, you know, that other countries have, and it's better in a measurable way. Per capita GDP, health, longevity, rights, the number of rights, the, you know, opportunities you have, the freedoms you have, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of travel, you know, just by any measure, as I show in all my chapters, that, you know, we can say this is really better than that. And I mean that really. And I mean that science can say, if this is the way something is, democracies are really better than autocracies and dictatorships, then we ought to do more of that. And in fact, what I'm saying is we already are doing all of that. We've been doing it for centuries. Let's quit saying that science has nothing to say about morality. You know, baloney. Science and reason have plenty to say about morality, and it's been saying it for centuries. We should just identify and keep doing it.
Well, that's quite often what the conversational tone is. You know, science is this sterile, objective other over here, and we'll let it calculate and do scientific things, and anything to do with sort of a moral compass, well, you know, that's not a scientific question. It's not a scientific dilemma, that kind of thing. But you're saying science actually plays right into how we determine right versus wrong, good versus bad.
Yep, absolutely. We do. And so the analogy I use is the public health model. You know, if you agree that saving hundreds of millions of lives through sanitation systems, flush toilets, vaccinations, and all the public health technologies we've been developing for two centuries, if you agree that saving hundreds of millions of lives through those is a good thing, then you're on board with me already. Because where in the world would people prefer to live in filth and disease-infested waters and pollution and living in misery and pain and suffering from diseases? This is not a Western democratic idea. This is a human idea. So I'm claiming that evolution vouchsafed us with this instinct for survival and flourishing, and that everybody would prefer that to not having that, and that can be a criteria. The way something is, this leads to more of that, this leads to less of that, then we should do more of the one and less of the other, and we already have been doing that. I mean, that's the whole point of when Jefferson described America as an experiment, the experiment in democracy. He meant it in a scientific sense, that let's try it this way, then let's try it that way. And, you know, it's a complex system. People make mistakes. People are greedy and so forth. There's all sorts of problems. So no one knows how to do this individually. So we all have to participate. We have these checks and balances, and we have these elections that are like experiments. You just tweak the variables and run it for a few years, tweak the variables, run it for a few years. And it's a never-ending, open-ended process of constantly tweaking the system.
What's the book? Is it just data sort of supporting the idea of secular morality? Is it sort of a demonstration of how we are better off today than we were yesterday? All the above, more? What's the story?
All of the above and more, yes. So I have the middle of the book has chapters on civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, and animal rights. The preceding chapters are on, you know, my theory of morality, the origins of the moral sense, how we can tell right from wrong, you know, how all the stuff we've been talking about. And then the last third of the book is on moral regress. You know, why is it that people commit evil deeds, and how is it that bad ideas like Nazism can take hold in a civil society like Germany? And, you know, what do we know about, you know, bad behavior, evil, and so on in order to avoid that? And then I have chapters on free will. You know, if the world's determined, then how is it we can hold people morally accountable? And I'm a compatibilist in the Dan Dennett sense that we are responsible. We are making free choices and we are responsible for them. And therefore, the next chapter on justice, you know, how should a justice system be structured? Well, most of our justice systems are retributive justice. It's, you know, payback, just desserts, lock them up, punish them, execute them, hang them, you know, electrocute them, whatever. But that's pretty barbaric. Part of the, you know, rational process of justice is restorative justice. First, let's see if we can restore the harm done to the victims. And second, let's see if we can fix the perpetrators. Why are they doing this? You know, is it economic? Is it political? Is it something wrong with their brains? Is it their upbringing? Are they fatherless, lack of education? What is it? Of course, those are all sciences that are, you know, the professional social scientists that do nothing but study those sorts of things. And we should do more of that. And then finally, I have a chapter on protopia, the future, not utopia, not dystopia. Those are ideas based on false theories of human nature. But protopia, small little incremental bits of progress every day is better than the day before. And there's lots of bumps along the road, two steps forward, one step back, and so on. But in the long run, I'm really optimistic. I'm not quite like Ray Kurzweil and the singularity is coming in 2030 and, you know, there'll be bliss and happiness for eternity after. I don't think that's the case. I just think, you know, 2030 will be better than 2029 and 2031 will be just a little bit better than 2030. And, you know, that's kind of how it goes in reality.
Hey, I was at a debate last year, the year before, I can't recall, and it was a debate on free will. I've been thinking about doing a show on free will, and of course, there was that discussion about, I think there were two determinists, and then there was a compatibilist, and the determinist was saying, you know, you may have the illusion of being able to have free will, but everything is predetermined. It is sort of a foregone conclusion. You're saying that we can actually exercise free will to choose one thing over another.
I am, yes. And I show that in these neuroscience experiments where people make a choice and, you know, we can see in the brain scans that their conscious brain that says, I just now made the choice. In fact, you can see in their motor neurons, they were starting to fire. You know, before the person was consciously aware of it, so some other part of their brain is making the choice for them. Well, first of all, it's still your brain making the choice. It isn't some little homunculus that dropped in. It's not a soul. You know, it's not some external force. It's you. It's your brain. But second of all, we know from additional research, since that original research by Benjamin LeBay, that you also have free will. You can override your choices. You can say, you know, I really, really, really want the chocolate cake, you know, but I'm not going to do it. And we know that at a level higher, we know you can train the brain to learn to resist those temptations. Anyway, so I make a pretty strong case for that, that I think we have free will. We can control it. Benjamin LeBay himself, who everybody cites in support of a deterministic model, was himself a compatibilist. He believed in free will. So it's a little bit ironic that his research.
Now, why do they call it a compatibilist? Is it you believe that free will, the choices that we make, there's an association with determinism, they are compatible in some way?
Yeah, that the choices you make are still within the causal net of the universe. So the whole universe is determined, yes, but your choices are part of that. So they're still your choices, you're making free choices, but within that, they're all, the universe is still determined.
That's a whole other show. That's just a whole other show, Michael.
I recommend Dan Dennett on this. He's very good. He's a professional philosopher. I'm not, so I can't pretend to tease out the little nuances of philosophical arguments. But his book, Freedom Evolves, I think develops this quite nicely. The idea of degrees of freedom, you know, like humans have more choices, more degrees of freedom than dogs more than, say, rats more than ants more than bacteria. You know, the more complex your system, your brain especially, then the more choices you have. So those are degrees of freedom of choice. And even within humans, I don't know if Dan argues this, but I do in the moral arc that, you know, those, say, addicts, drug addicts, alcoholics, people with brain damage and so on, you know, they have fewer degrees of freedom. And the law already accounts for that. You know, that, you know, if you know, like this guy who's being tried for killing the American sniper. You know, maybe he had PTSD, you know, so the discussion will be to what extent does PTSD interfere with your, you know, free will, your free won't, your ability to choose. So mitigating circumstances certainly can influence that. But the general principle is that, yes, we are free and we should be held morally accountable for our choices.
Dr. Michael Shermer. The new book's called The Moral Arc. I will link it in the description box of this broadcast, or you can simply go to the website, Moral Arc, that is A-R-C, moralarc.org. The book is called The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. I wish you all success with it. Thanks for spending a half an hour on the radio with us tonight.
Great. Thanks, Seth. I really appreciate that.
Next week's broadcast is a conversation between myself and the hosts of Cognitive Dissonance. So buckle up, because it's going to be a ride. That's happening next Tuesday night. Now that the broadcast is over tonight, don't forget to log on and support our sponsor, naturebox.com/thinkingatheist, with great tasting and wholesome snacks like sweet blueberry almonds. Log on, check it out, naturebox.com/thinkingatheist.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.